Listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio AM 820 brings you Foundations in Faith. Join Monsignor Frank Lane as he offers insights into the readings heard at Mass. And now, Foundations in Faith with Monsignor Frank Lane.
This is Father Frank Lane, and we are continuing our program, Foundations in Faith. We've been following the Gospel according to Matthew, and today we're going to continue with that, Matthew 22, 1-14. And what's happening is that Matthew is moving into a dangerous world, kind of. Jesus is entering into a dangerous world in Matthew's Gospel, a world in which there is a very graphic and stark criticism of the chief priests and the elders of the people. It is where Jesus sets up, through the use of parables, an image of the infidelity of the people of the covenant and God's intention, in a way, to endure their infidelity up to a point, and then at a certain point to take action against them and to let them know for sure that things are now going to change dramatically. There's going to be a new group of people to whom the Lord extends his covenant and his word. And that in the one in the parable that Matthew does about the vineyard, when the tenants of the vineyard kill the people he sends and then kill his son, obviously he's talking about the prophets and about himself, Jesus is. Now, in a very similar way, he talks about the king who gives the great banquet for his son's wedding. It's a different kind of a social dynamic, a different kind of a dynamic that has to do with the way people live. But nevertheless, the message remains powerfully the same. He decides to throw this great banquet for his son who's getting married, and then sends out the invitations. And everyone, of course, rejects in the story. They reject the invitation. They're just too busy. They're just too concerned about the things of this world, about the things of their ordinary life. And so they don't pay any attention to the invitations. And finally, even, they went off to his farm, another to his business. The rest seized his servants, maltreated them, and even killed them. So once again, these servants that go out to invite the people to the banquet are the prophets in this parable. And that the people reject the prophets. And I think if you read through the Hebrew Scriptures, it's really kind of interesting how that rejection takes place. It's really interesting when... and I don't recall the king. I think it was Jehoiakim, I think, who secretly goes to Jeremiah and says, "What am I to do about the Babylonians coming?" And if I'm wrong in the name of the king, I apologize for that. And Jeremiah says, "Well, what you should do is surrender, because if you don't surrender, if you try to resist, you will be killed, your whole family will be killed, the city will be burned, and so on and so forth." And even with a graphic prophecy, he trusted Jeremiah enough to go to Jeremiah to ask him his advice. When Jeremiah tells him what the Lord has said, he violates it because he's afraid of what the nobility will do if he voluntarily surrenders. And so he fights, and of course they're all killed, and the city is burned to the ground, and the people carried off into exile, exactly as Jeremiah had said would happen. So the prophets, even when they were taken seriously, were ignored by the highest powers in Israel. And certainly we know that they were mistreated. We know the story of Jezebel wanting to kill Elijah, and he had to flee and pursuing him. All this, it's a really tawdry story about human nature, is what it's all about, really. Human nature that refuses to come into any kind of relationship with truth, reality, structures of the world as they truly are. Everyone always thinks in some way, shape, or form, and this was true of the story in the Garden of Eden, they think that they can change themselves and their world all on their own. And so that's what they set out to do. The modern age is not certainly alien to this kind of experience. And even within the church, we find people who, accepting the power sources of the world and thinking that somehow or other they have the skill to outplay the game of worldly societies and economic systems and so forth. Ultimately, of course, they are rejected, and ultimately, of course, they fail. And it is the faithful ones. It is the ones who suffer during these periods of infidelity but they are also the ones then who survive and become the hope and the seed of a new age, of a new time, of a new people. Well, that's what's going on here in this story of the chief priests and the elders and the feast, the king who are and those who are invited to the wedding. So then it says, after the rejection, when they have killed his servants, he dispatched his troops, destroyed those murderers, and burned down their town. So what happens is eventually we push that so far, we play the game so strongly that eventually we are rejected. And in that rejection comes a collapse. And in that collapse then, there is a new growth, a new possibility, a new hope. That's why, you know, they say that martyrdom, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the faith and so forth. That it is the faithful ones, not necessarily the blood martyrs, but the white martyrs as well, the ones who suffer greatly in the periods of great infidelity and to the Lord. They are the ones who, suffering greatly, eventually emerge as the seedbed of the resurgence and the rebirth of the church in a particular time and in a particular place. So when we find then that he has destroyed the murderers and burnt their towns, in other words, he has rejected those who have rejected him, is what Jesus is saying. Then he says to his servants, well, the wedding certainly is ready, but those who are invited prove to be unworthy. So go to the crossroads in the town and invite everyone you can find into the wedding. So these servants went out to the roads and collected together everyone they could find, bad and good alike. And the wedding hall was filled with guests. All right. That's kind of interesting, too, that now there is no longer this exclusivity in the invitation to people into the covenant, in our terminology, into the church. It's open to all. And the good and the bad alike. I remember when I was on active duty in the army, and there was two Catholics who got in a knife fight or something, and I was called out as a Catholic chaplain, and it was night and so forth. And the next day, a friend of mine, the Jewish chaplain, was laughing, and he said, "Well, see what happens when you let everybody in." Well, that's exactly what's going on here. We're letting everybody in. That's the image of the church. Everybody can come into the church, the good and the bad alike, but not on a free ride, not with no responsibility, not with no accountability, because see what happens next. When the king came in to look at the guests, he noticed one man was not wearing a wedding garment. He said to him, "How did you get in here, my friend, without a wedding garment? And the man was silent. And then the king said to the attendants, "Bind him hand and foot and throw him into the outer darkness, where there will be the weeping and the gnashing of teeth. For many are called, but few are chosen." The many are called and few are chosen is not a numerical proposition. It's not some kind of Calvinistic understanding of the redeemed and the damned at all. It's just saying that among those who are called, there will always be those who do not accept the call, who do not respond to that call. And that's an important thing for us to ponder as well. It's kind of like in the writings of St. Francis of Assisi, he makes a very interesting distinction. He says that, you know, redemption has come into the world through Jesus Christ, through his sacrifice and resurrection, that we are redeemed. But then he goes on to say, but that doesn't mean that each person is saved. Redemption is the gift that the Lord offers to the world. Salvation involves the necessity of our response to that gift. Now, a lot of times in the interpretations of St. Francis and in the romanticism about St. Francis and so forth, this idea that, you know, this quintessential nice guy who is a quasi-environmentalist and hangs out in modern backyards and bird baths and so forth is a perversion of who St. Francis of Assisi was. He was very, very sensitive to the power of sin. And in fact, in his Canticle of the Creatures, he says, woe to those who die in mortal sin. And then when he talks about redemption and salvation, he says, yes, we are redeemed. Certainly we are redeemed. But in order to be saved, we have to respond. We have to participate. We have to give back to the Lord something that the Lord has asked us for. And that's what this is all about here. Everyone's invited. That's redemption. Everyone's invited. But then not everybody responds to that invitation adequately or properly, and that they are thrown out into the outer darkness where there will be the weeping and the gnashing of teeth. This idea of the universal salvation of humanity, which is a hope, which it would be wonderful if such were the case, but we have strong indications that God does not violate the freedom of people, and that those who definitely choose not to be saved are not chosen, are not saved. I know that Karl Rahner says we have to believe in hell. We don't have to believe anybody's there. That's true. We know that in Origen there is a sense of universal salvation, which became doctrinally questionable. We know, for instance, in the writings of Hans Urs von Balthasar, there is the famous, dare we believe all men be saved. There is this idea, because of the enormous grandeur and power of God, this idea that he is, that the cosmos itself is minuscule compared to the vastness and the greatness of God, that how could God lose something which he created? And so there is this great desire that somehow or other all men can be saved. But there is also the reality and the fact that there are those who do not want to be saved. And the Lord is most respectful of our personal freedom. That's what makes it this is interesting, in the theology of St. Bernard of Clairvaux, that the greatest attribute of the divine is freedom. That God is not in any way determined or coerced into anything. And then Bernard says that our image of God is in our will, which is also, therefore, in an imitation of the divine. It is an element, a faculty of freedom. Well, if God were to take that freedom away from us, we would no longer be in his image. And if we were no longer in his image, according to this particular way of looking at things, we simply would no longer even be human and would not participate in the destiny of the human person. So Bernard makes it very clear that freedom is a very critical element of the constituency of the human person, the construct of the human person, and that without that freedom, we can't really function as human beings. And so God allows us then to be like him in the way that we exercise freedom. And so we have to presume that there are those who in their freedom would choose not to be with God, but would choose instead darkness. There's a great book by C.S. Lewis called The Great Divorce, and it's a story about humanity kind of making this choice and basically liking it better to be separate from God than to be in his presence. And we certainly know that in the story of humanity, there are many who have chosen darkness over the light of Jesus Christ. Many outside the church, many within the church, in history and in our modern age as well. God is not going to refuse them that option. Now, well, the thing that we don't know, and this is the integral part of it, the thing that we don't know is how great or how little is there a residual of freedom in each human person? Because of original sin, our theology says, that freedom and that goodness is circumscribed. It is circumscribed by the impact and the effect of sin. The result of it is, as the Council of Trent reminds us, that we have no right whatsoever to proclaim anything about the eternal destination of anybody. We cannot say someone is in hell, nor can we say someone is in heaven. Unless, on the part of being in heaven, God so manifests their presence there. And that's what the need for a miracle is in the canonization process. It is God's affirmation to us, God's communication to us, of the eternal destiny of this person who is being investigated and explored. We cannot, on the other hand, say that God is going to manifest to us the signs of darkness and the signs of evil, because God himself would not do that. And so if someone is not in heaven, that's not something that we will know for sure. We have deep suspicions about it. For instance, in various stories of diabolical possession, when a demon will identify themselves and sometimes identify themselves as an actual person who was involved in the life of this other person, or it identify themselves as inscription simply by the name of Legion. But we cannot be sure, since the Prince of Darkness is also the Prince of Lies. We don't know for sure how authentic the testimony is that the demons give as to their own identity. But when God gives the sign, when he enables someone to work a miracle, then what that is God affirming in goodness that this person is with him in heaven. So when, in fact, we talk about this idea of the good, we cannot get into some of this predestination stuff that the Calvinists were into, and we cannot get into some of this righteous stuff that some of the fundamentalists are into, where they proclaim people damned. They can't do that. They have no idea. They do not know what was going on in the mind of that person. They cannot know the limitations that person had from their background, their upbringing, their environment, their society. They can't know any of those kinds of things for sure and for certain. Nor do they know the disposition at the last moment of that person's life. They do not know that did not entail, in a split second even, a conversion experience. So we cannot do that. Even Ezekiel says, you know, even if a just man turns to evil, he will die. And if an evil man turns and does just things, he will live. There is always the possibility of the conversion until death itself is total and complete in the person's life. And so what we find then is that we cannot use things like this to condemn anybody to hell. We can say these evils, and that's basically this whole idea about judging other people. It's a big issue. It's a big thing. It doesn't mean you cannot judge behavior, because you can. It doesn't mean that you can't judge something as being wicked, because you can judge something as being wicked. Parents have to do that all the time with their children. I don't want you to go to this area. I don't want you to play with these children. These children, they steal, or they smoke pot, or they do drugs of some kind, and I don't want you around that. That's a judgment, and that's a reasonable judgment. That's a responsible judgment. It's a responsible judgment to say, I'm not going into this place where I won't be safe. I'm not going to send someone I love into something where their harm will come to them. All of those are legitimate judgments. We can also judge the action of violations of God's law. We can judge actions about the violation. It's not pastoral to say, well, we're tolerant of people, even though they do things objectively wrong. That's not pastoral at all. That's deceitful. That's pure deception and cowardice. What we cannot do is say, because that person does something wrong, they are a bad person. That we cannot do. And this becomes very much a part of the modern political scene. We cannot, therefore, interact with people who do bad things from a motivation of hatred of people whom God has created and given a living soul, because we don't know why they do the horrendous things that they do. Whether it is betrayal within the church, whether it is murder in the name of another culture or religion, whether it is absolute brutality that the Boko Haram in Nigeria or the ISIS in Iraq and the ghastly things they do to people, especially to Christians, hatred's not our response. It's not the response of a Christian, because to hate them means we have judged their soul. What we can judge, and judge adamantly, and judge verbally and vocally, is that what they are doing is wrong, is objectively wrong. We can do that. Those are extreme cases of doing wrong. There's wrong that goes on in our own families, and there's wrong that goes on in our society, and there's wrong that goes on in our church. There's wrong when people, you know, are more concerned about their sources of income than about the gospel of Jesus Christ in the global life of the church. Those things are wrong. But we cannot say that the people who do those things are damned. We can't say that. And so here, what Jesus has let us know in the gospel is that everybody is called good and bad. We let everybody in. But in once inside, there is the necessity of responding to the invitation to salvation. St. Francis will say that. This is a great place to look at what St. Francis says. The call to all to enter is redemption. The throwing out of the one who has not responded to the invitation is the question of salvation. And so when we deal now with our own church and in our own lives, we have to realize that not one of us has what we call kind of a free ride, an entitlement. It's really interesting. Of all the entitlement language that begins to enter into faith in an age of great entitlements, we have to ignore dogma, or we have to ignore doctrine, or we have to ignore the words of Scripture. There's even a cardinal who says that, you know, Jesus' words, for instance, on divorce are too harsh and so forth. All right, let's criticize Jesus to get what we want. I think that's pretty bizarre. And yet it has to do with a language of entitlement. And so we have to give up the idea of Jesus' idea of the all-male priesthood, because people have a right to the Eucharist. And, you know, it's not true. People who do have a right to receive the Eucharist, but they also have the responsibility, therefore, to produce the priests to confect that Eucharist and to administer that Eucharist to them, to share that Eucharist with them. It's a question, I don't have to give up, we don't have to give up any of our sons to the church, and yet we are entitled to everything that the priesthood in the church can offer us. And rather than respond from our own, you know, our own responsibilities, we're simply going to say, all right, now it doesn't matter what Jesus said or did. Now it's going to be our way. I mean, so that's Eve in the garden. That's all this kind of stuff. all the way through. Jesus, God's way is not our way, but we're going to make it our way so that we can get what we want because we are a people entitled. This is what is so harsh in these Gospels to the chief priests and the leaders, because they have lived in a covenanted society that was entitled to election. And what Jesus says to them is, you are no longer entitled to election. Election now is open to everybody, and you can't have it for free. You have to respond to it now in authenticity, in faith, and in respect for God and for his laws. Think about that. Think about if we were to say that in the modern church. Sorry, we are not automatically entitled to salvation through baptism. It demands from us a response. And if you don't give the response, then you're not included in the chosen, in the elect, in the people of the covenant. But that's your choice. God has given you the opportunity. In this gospel, in the gospel about the vineyard and so forth, God is offering the opportunity. And here it's very clear. He said, and so these servants went out onto the roads and collected together everyone they could find, good and bad alike, and the wedding hall was filled with guests. Well, that's the story of the extension. That's the story of the extension of the opportunity for redemption to all peoples. But imagine the anger of the Pharisees and the scribes when they were told, you are no longer entitled to this position that you have held for so long, that now it is for everyone, and everyone is invited then to respond to that invitation. As we ponder this, as we think about this, as we pray about this, let's look at ourselves, and let's look at the world in which we live, and let's look at how the church works in the modern world, and pray that this great insight into the relationship of redemption and salvation is opened up for us in the parables of Jesus, here in this Gospel of St. Matthew, certainly other places, and that the opportunity that it gives us to be active participants in our own redemption, and to be those who love and respect the Lord so fully and completely that we are willing to live our lives according to his word and according to his presence.
Foundations in Faith is a production of listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio, AM 820. Archives of Foundations in Faith are available at stgabrielradio.com.